Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezi Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today, we're speaking with Professor Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar, and his most recent essay is entitled, It Is Time to Apply the Fifth Amendment to Losses Suffered by Business Owners and Workers. In case you're not familiar with the professor, I don't know how you couldn't be, recognize that he is a socioeconomic research scholar, and he's based out of Newark with, what was the name of the college? Forgive me, I'm losing it. I guess I'm just like a little confused today. So whatever the case is, we're going to be talking about eminent domain, and what's fascinating about it is eminent domain really relates to what's been going on with the COVID crisis. So, good morning, Professor. How are you today? Oh, let's see. Hold on a minute. Maybe when I moved over here, somehow he moved into a quiet spot. Yeah. Okay, that's not his fault, it's mine. Good morning, Professor. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning.
Well, this is a very, very exciting tale. Well, you understood it from the very beginning, and I know that you've been professing it maybe in more subtle terms than you did to this time, so maybe it didn't quite pierce my cranium, but evidently it's a very solid concept. And the premise is that it is time to apply the Fifth Amendment to losses suffered by business owners and workers. And you begin your concept by stating that state officials have been hiding behind a fiction that businesses are shuttered and people are out of work because of a pandemic. And you mentioned that this is only partly true. So explain that so people get it, because it took me a while to get it.
Well, I mean, the pandemic has basically been the justification for the exercises of all broad emergency powers by governors throughout the country. Actually, mm-hmm. It's been the justification for the exercise of those emergency powers by governing officials throughout the world. The end result is that you have government shutdowns of large swaths of the economy, and the result is that people are put out of work and businesses are basically going under, and nobody is really compensating these businesses for their losses. What you see is haggling over COVID relief bills. You know, should we give $1,400 to families? In many cases, families that haven't lost any real money because they're still working and they're working remotely. But we're haggling over that, and we're haggling over whether we should give more money for the schools to reopen and things of that nature. Should we give money to the states and localities that have lost money, and so on and so forth? And, of course, we have in this COVID relief bill, you know, money for humanities research and other sacred cows of different members of Congress. It's a traditional pork barrel politics, but it's not really addressing the issues that are facing us.
But what you point out in your essay is simply straightforward, and that this needs to be addressed, and that it goes back to history in the days of the old sovereigns in England, who could decide willy-nilly what they wanted to do with your property, and they could throw you off the land because they didn't care for you or they disliked you or, I don't know, you smirked at them at the wrong time. How does this relate, the eminent domain and what's going on with the COVID crisis now?
Well, if this were traditional eminent domain, what you would see is a set of procedures put into place to protect the rights of property owners. So, you know, in the case of, the sovereign, let's say the state of New Jersey or the state of New York, wants to build a highway. So they basically are going to bulldoze an entire neighborhood to make room for the highway. And you're going to justify this action on the grounds that it's for the public good, it's a public purpose. So the idea here is, okay, so letters of condemnation are sent out to the owners of property. The owners of property then have the right to attend a public hearing whereby they can contest this decision by public officials to condemn their land. And then at some point, if they don't get redress of the grievances through these public hearings, they have the right to challenge the state or locality in a courtroom. And you could have a case going all the way up to the Supreme Court addressing the rights of property owners versus the state. If the state prevails, the idea is then the state is required to compensate property owners for their loss of fair market value. Mm-hmm. Now, the purpose of this really is the idea that you want the sovereign to think twice about seizing property. You don't want to make it easy for them to do it. You want to make it more difficult. And you want them to be doubly sure it's absolutely necessary to seize this particular property for a public purpose, because if you have to compensate for every time you do it, then you could go broke. You want to think twice before you actually make that decision. It has to be absolutely correct. So that's the idea. So what you're trying to do is create a buffer around your particular interest. And this sort of goes back to the idea that the value of the property is a result of the labor that you invested into that property. By investing your labor, you actually gave that property more value. Now, it should not be taken that, and some people have taken it, to mean that, well, the property rights are sacrosanct. They're not, really. But what you're doing here is you're creating a zone of protection, a buffer against the state, so the state will not be able to exercise authority in an arbitrary fashion. Basically, everything has to be just publicly justified. That's sort of the essence of liberal governance, if you will. So what you're doing is you're creating this zone of protection. You're trying, it's a bulwark against arbitrary exercise of power and authority. And what you're seeing now at the state level, particularly with these lockdowns, these governors are just getting up, they're making these announcements, and they're not necessarily basing it on, you know, cost-benefit risk analysis where you have the input of the scientists versus the input of the economists and so on and so forth. They're just simply taking one set of recommendations from the medical community, whose only job really is to think in terms of public health. They're not there to think in terms of economic health or psychological health or the other costs associated with these particular lockdowns. They're just not there to think in terms of protecting the public health as though that's the public good and the only public good. But what it does effectively, it absolves the public official of responsibility. But for the ordinary property owner, I'm talking about the business owner who's forced to shut his or her doors. And even if you don't have to shut your doors, but you have to reduce your capacity to 25%, the value of your property has now been sufficiently diminished. And you could be in a position where you may be forced to shut down permanently down the road. But to that property owner, the action seems arbitrary. But again, no attempt is being made to compensate for the loss. As far as the workers concerned, they are absolute pawns in all this. They're basically being told, well, sorry, you're out of a job because, you know, we don't have the capacity, therefore we can't keep you on the payroll. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it were an ordinary recession, you'd say, okay, people are afraid to come out because of coronavirus, whatever the case may be, or there's a downturn in the business cycle, so we have to lay you off. That's not what's going on here. This is really a function of a governmental action. So the coronavirus simply has become the excuse. But it's really the governmental action, the closure, the mandated requirements to shut down, which is resulting in these in this so-called recession.
Mm-hmm. So where are we supposed to go from here, and who invokes the Fifth Amendment? Because there were very few cases. There was one case in Connecticut years ago, I remember, but I've forgotten the name of it, that was with regard to eminent domain. And then the big one that I read about was in the Bronx, the Cross County Expressway, that ended up needing to be taken over by eminent domain. And they, like you said, they had to go through a whole process, and they compensated the buildings that would straddle the Cross Bronx Expressway on both sides. I guess it was east and west, and everyone was happy at the end, even though it split the Bronx in half. And I think the Bronx is still paying for it, so it may have worked out for the highways, but it didn't work out for the community so well. But how do we bring this forward, and why haven't the progressives or the people from the right, why hasn't anyone challenged this whole issue?
Well,
are they afraid to?
I think the issue for the progressives is that they, you know, it'd be one thing to challenge it on the for the benefit of workers, but here we're talking about business owners too, well, as well as workers. And they don't want to be seen as protecting the rights of business owners, whom, for all as far as they're concerned, they're all billionaires and millionaires and billionaires. So, you know, we can't protect them, which is kind of ludicrous when you come right down to it. But that's one thing that's going on. The other thing is, quite frankly, if you can simply make them dependent on the state, and then you have further justification for more leftist policies like universal basic income and a few other things, free this and free that, and then you basically purchase their votes for eternity. Now, that's the cynical view of things, but I think that's where we are.
We're fading.
At this point.
Yeah.
It's surprising to me that the ACLU, of all people, has not taken up this case. They take up the rights of various people when the states has undertaken an action ordered by Republican governors, but not ordered by Democratic governors. And it's kind of bizarre. You are stripping people of their basic civil liberties when you're basically saying, in effect, you don't have a right to earn a living, which is essentially what you're doing here. In other words, you have a right to work. It's a negative right. That is, the government cannot interfere with your right to make a living. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's the whole basis for a whole slew of anti-discrimination law legislation that we have had over the last 60, 70 years. Basically, you're removing barriers to people's fundamental right to work. As a negative right. I'm not talking about a positive right. If it were to be a positive right to work, then government would actually be obligated to provide those opportunities to work and make a living, actually employ people as a measure of last resort. But we're talking about the negative right. And here, states are violating, trampling that basic negative right, again, without any real compensation. So to some people, what I'm proposing is would come off as a radical concept. Oh, we're going to reimburse employees for their full loss of wages, and that's absurd. They're going to say that we're going to reimburse employers even though they still technically own their businesses. That's also absurd. Well, that's not really. You basically, if you actually had to do that. And it really would cost the state a good deal of money for those decisions, then again, they would think twice about doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember reading the 21 Club. I've never been there, but a very expensive place, evidently a restaurant, but they evidently had to shut down. I'm sure they were wealthy people. They had a big restaurant, very, very well heeled. Clientele, supposedly, and yet they had to shut down, which means all their employers, all the employees, also lost their jobs, and they couldn't function on 25% capacity when they were used to 100%, and they needed that in order to be able to make a profit. So why the disconnect? Is there something that we're trying to hold on to? Are we trying to protect the coffers of the state, whether it be the local states or the federal government, so that they don't have to compensate for these losses that are inflicted upon society by them, by their policies?
I think we're protecting the basic fundamental right to take the easy way out and be ignorant of basic rights laws and a few other things. So basically what you have are politicians saying, in effect, I just followed, quote, the science. I listened to my scientists, therefore I made a decision. And that's all I have to do. If you're really arrogant about it, so like the governor of New York, you say, of course we're saving people's lives. How dare you question that? Well, what do you mean you want to make a living? You want to make a living when people's lives are at stake? Well, yeah, people want to make a living because they want to support their families. But if you want to deny them the right to make the living, then you really have an obligation to compensate them for it.
Yeah. And then does the public buy into this whole concept of getting a $1,400 check or $600 check, whatever it is, as an incentive to so people could buy food and pay their rent? Even if you pay the rent, I don't think $1,400 is going to go very far. Maybe some people pay more than $1,400 in rent in a month, and other people it may take them 3 or 4 months to pay that. But they can't last like that without a job. So why are we going this way? Were the Swedes correct in saying we're going to build herd immunity in a different way and not shut down? But now I hear that they're going back and doing what everybody else has been doing.
It's hard to say who was correct and who was incorrect. Because I think it's a learning curve which people don't really have any answer to. So they basically, you know, dust the old toolbox of things that we've done in the past and say, well, let's keep doing it. Now, the problem is when it doesn't work, they're afraid to come out and say, okay, let's change course. We made a mistake. They won't say never say we made a mistake because there's too much hubris involved here. But so they basically double down. You know, the whole question of the Swedes and herd immunity, you know, you do pay a heavy cost if you go that route. But then, you know, we could have taken steps to protect the most vulnerable populations and kept as much open as possible. I think things get lost in this debate that we have between red states and blue states. You know, red states governors are more liberal and they're keeping their states open, whereas blue state governors want to shut down. I think what gets lost there is that blue states are absolutely more populous than the red states, and you have more people congregating together. So you have much larger cities where you can have more spread, whereas in some of these red states, like South Dakota, people are not living in big cities. So you don't really have that same risk of spread that you do in the blue states. So we're missing that, and people get fixated on the fundamental rights. I do think that probably a lot of lives were lost because this issue was politicized by those on the right who wanted to turn this in, particularly on Fox News, you wanted to turn this into a fundamental civil rights issue of being forced to wear a mask. No, I'm not going to wear a mask. It's my right to not wear a mask, so on and so forth. Actually, it's not your right to not wear a mask. It's because, you know, as John Stuart Mill basically put it, your liberty ends where my nose begins. Like, quite literally. So if you cause harm to others, then in fact your liberty can be curtailed. The idea here is that the purpose of wearing a mask is to protect others from you. That's why you're wearing the mask. If they do likewise, you're protected from them. Now, the point here is that's the least intrusive restriction when you get right down to it. But yet here we had people arguing, no, it's my right to not wear a mask. And then you had a presidential candidate, a president himself, holding these big rallies where nobody was wearing a mask, basically sending the message, it's not necessary. The public health officials that say we should wear a mask, they don't know what they're talking about.
Well, we just learned only a couple of days ago that over 500,000 people died from COVID, and it seems a very, very huge number. And I heard somebody talking about it, and they say, "Well, we had a different government, and with this government, they expect things will change a little bit." But everyone claimed that they were doing the right thing with the previous government, but it was politicized. And maybe it's going to be less politicized now. I'm not sure. It's a little bit too early to tell. But it seems like both Republicans and Democrats are maybe they're on the same page, but they're defining it a little bit differently. And yet at the same time, the public and the workers are getting the shaft, as I think that was the last word you entered in your piece here. So is there a way to make a correction, or are we too far gone and we're just into this, you know, satiate the public and don't make them aware of what the law should or how the law should be interpreted so that everybody benefits? Is that where we're at? Are we buying the votes by making believe we're doing the right thing?
That seems to be where we are, because obviously there are plenty of Republicans who are willing to purchase those votes too with this $1,400 stimulus payments. So they think it's good for their poll numbers too. But again, nobody has really thought through public policy, but nobody really is there to think through public policy. They're simply there to represent, whatever the term represent means, if that means purchasing votes through programs or tax benefits or whatever. That's precisely what they do, and that's a problem.
And does the public, are we that naive as potential voters? Or are we quite astute? It seems that we're not as astute as I thought we were, because we're buying into these con games, and it seems to be a con game, because everyone's losing out in the process. You know, the well-to-do, they've never lost a dime, so they're okay. We don't have to worry about them. But the people who are working for a living, and I don't even know if they're getting a $15 minimum wage or not, a lot of them are, you know, deficient in food and can't pay their rent, facing evictions eventually, and so on and so forth. It doesn't look like there's a happy ending here.
This has not been about working people, and certainly has not been about protecting the interests of working people. And if you really wanted to protect the interests of working people, and you just take the whole vaccination rollout itself and the whole criteria for determining who gets a vaccine. So, you know, clearly, you know, if you really cared about working people, you'd say all those workers who have contact with the public or actually have to go to a physical location to work, because they have to do so, they're at risk, they should be a priority in getting a vaccine regardless of their age. That's not what we did.
Okay.
We were basically making distinctions. Well, are you a food worker? Now it's, are you a restaurant worker? You know, obviously, healthcare workers should be first priority. That makes sense. But what didn't make sense was you didn't include their families in that priority. The healthcare workers are coming home to their families and exposing them. So, you know, you're not you're making these distinctions which don't make sense. What they should have done, which Connecticut finally has done, there was a Wall Street Journal about that this morning, they finally said, let's do what some other countries are doing, based on age. You know, when we start with the oldest people, we vaccinate them first, and we go down the list. You know, and we don't make these exceptions. That would make the most sense, because after all, so the older you are, the more more at risk you are for contracting COVID-19. So, you know,
yeah.
It makes sense to vaccinate the older and the more vulnerable first, but that's not what we've been doing, particularly in New York, where we're
mm-hmm.
making distinctions for this and distinctions for that, and now we want to put, we want to vaccinate the certain neighborhoods over other neighborhoods based on principles of equity and social justice. A lot of it strikes most people as being arbitrary.
Yeah, that's the way it seems. It's whatever suits the moment. And so it doesn't... Look, even when you talk about social equity, there are a lot of people of color who refuse to take the inoculation. They remember the days from 90 years back when the Tuskegee experiment on syphilis, instead of giving them penicillin, they watched people, mostly of color, die when they could have given them the antidote, which was the penicillin. But, you know, I would reflect on that. Is that how do people remember what happened 90 years ago? And the truth is, I remember what my parents said, because I never met my grandparents, but I remember what my parents said. And so it's their history that I was able to remember to this day. And then so I remember that 90-year span, so to speak. And so that's where it comes from. But we're not reaching out to the African-American community or even the Hispanic community. I remember years ago, they were feeding chickens with hormones, and they were selling the chickens in Puerto Rico, and then the girls, because of the hormones that they used them to grow the chickens, they ended up going through early puberty. And that was the atrocity they pulled in Puerto Rico. So everywhere you look, there's a failing here. And we're not reaching out to people and telling them it's okay and safe. Blacks and Hispanics are not taking the inoculation. Isn't that supposed to defeat the herd immunity thing?
One would think. Then you're sort of forced to address other complicated legal issues. At some point, can you force people to be vaccinated? We do it for the schools.
It's
a violation of their civil liberties. But if you have a group
mm-hmm.
of people that say we're not going to be vaccinated, do various institutions and say businesses have a right to say, okay,
mm-hmm.
fine, you aren't vaccinated, you can't enter. If you say
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to serve because you haven't been vaccinated, are you then violating the 1964 Civil Rights Act, where people are entitled to public accommodation? So you have this host of legal issues that you sort of have to address with this whole vaccination question. The truth is that people choose not to be vaccinated for whatever reason, they may be putting other people
mm-hmm.
at risk. And that
yeah.
Becomes a serious public health concern. I can see a scenario down the road where people who will get vaccinated will be given some kind of passport that says they can enter here and enter there and sort of live a normal
yeah.
life in restaurants and whatnot and theaters and, you know, entertainment venues, and life will proceed almost back to normal. They'll be able to board planes, go to travel places. Those who do not will not be able to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
Is that traditional discrimination? Well, I mean, it's the idea would be to encourage you to get vaccinated if you want to be able to participate in, quote, normal life, unquote. Now, then the choice is up to you. But there are going to be people who say, but that's discriminatory. Especially if those who are choosing not to be vaccinated happen to be primarily people of color.
Well, looks like the Supreme Court would be very busy if they took all these issues on, and they'd probably be exhausted too. It would require a redo of our social and economic and political system in the United States, wouldn't it?
It would basically require an overhaul of existing law and basically the application of that law. And the question will be, what constitutes the public interest here? If you if you can require that kids be vaccinated for a whole host of reasons to be able to attend school, then arguably you could require people to be vaccinated for the coronavirus to attend life, so to speak. You could do that. Why one and not the other? Now, if you say, I don't want to be vaccinated because I don't have enough data and information on this vaccine, I want to wait, that may be a legitimate concern. And we're already seeing, you know, employers, particularly restaurants in New York, basically firing people who said, well, I'm not ready to be vaccinated yet.
And what about the anti-vaxxers? Could they get into the mix? Would that make it very difficult for us to have everyone vaccinated in order that everyone is protected? Assuming the science is correct. I don't even know if the science is correct. I would hope it is.
I don't know what the anti-vaxxers' argument is right now. They say we don't have enough data. And they're going to claim the data we have is just sufficient to provide emergency use on these vaccines. That having been said, we actually have very good data coming out of Israel right now, which is basically because of a partnership between some of their health clinics and Pfizer to test this, and basically what they're showing now is that those who received just the first dose of a vaccine, the infection rate in Israel has declined by 75%. This is from the health ministry in Israel. And then for those who have received two doses, the infection rate is now 1 in 1,000. That's pretty good. Yeah. And that's pretty good, much a solid argument for why you should get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. But we don't seem to be doing that here. We're not like proselytizing, hey, this is the best conduct. So is that part of our freedom of choice? And can we afford that freedom of choice when so much is at stake, people's lives are at stake? Maybe, you know, if you don't feel it for yourself, you probably feel it for your parents or your children or your friends. My God, I practically cracked, you know, fell apart. I heard someone, I don't know her that well, but she's sick. And I said, my God, you know, she was healthy last week, and now she's in hospital. It's gut-wrenching. And a young woman, too, must be in her 50s. Well, for someone my age, 50 is young. So are we lost at the moment? We're just like, it seems like our society's befuddled.
Again, these are issues that nobody has really thought about. Certainly has not crossed the minds of most of the typical citizen out there. It's not something public officials are going to easily bring up. They think they're operating in the interest of the public good. And, you know, state legislatures having not wanted to deal with these issues, they feel like they want to pass the buck and sort of absolve themselves of responsibility. They've been all too willing to pass laws giving their governors even greater emergency power and authority to make these kinds of decisions. I'm not sure they should have this much authority, and the legislature should really take it back. But once you've delegated, it's very difficult to return it. So that's part of the problem. It's kind of baffling that organizations like the ACLU have not taken this up. It's true that there's kind of a whole debate on the applicability of the Fifth Amendment takings clause. But I think there's a good argument for why it does apply. In the 1950s and 60s, when they were building Kennedy Airport, for example, and you'd have planes flying over the neighborhoods and basically property owners would challenge the state and say, "But we weren't compensated for the diminished value in our property." The court basically, Supreme Court basically held they were entitled to compensation under the laws of eminent domain for precisely that reason, because they were in the glide path to the runways. Now, so that's a precedent for compensating business owners and workers. Though the case for workers is a little more difficult because we haven't really defined workers' work as property rights and labor, which really needs to happen for a whole host of reasons. That's one issue. The second issue is, of course, the whole question, do you still possess the property in question, even if its value has been diminished? And here, there's a case that sort of works against property owners. There's a famous case that's formed fairly, it's more recent in the last few years, Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Commission, where basically, you know, following a series of floods and beach erosion, a commission in South Carolina basically passed an ordinance saying you can't build on the beach. So it has to be, you know, sort of set back several miles. Now, we had a case of a developer that bought property for the purpose of developing this property and building condominiums or whatever, beachfront condominiums, figuring being on the beach will basically bring in a real profit. They can basically sell these condominiums at a high price. This ordinance basically prohibited that, and the owner said the value of my property has in fact been diminished. Therefore, I'm entitled to just compensation from the state of South Carolina. Well, the Supreme Court basically said, well, you still own the property, and you still have the right to sit there and enjoy the stars. So, you know, in other words, you know, you say, yes, maybe the value in terms of money has been diminished, but there maybe there are other values to owning the property on the beach. So, again, it can work the other way around, but at least we should have the discussion. And we're not even having that discussion.
Yeah. Wow. And we always talk about the role of the unions that have been diminished in their capacity over, I don't know, I guess the last 50 years. Can the unions get involved in any way, shape, or form? Because they employ a lot of people, or the people that are employed in businesses are members of the union as well. But the unions have also been quiet on this issue. Are they not? They have lawyers, so they have people who would know this stuff. You would expect. You know, not everyone is a longshoreman who doesn't have a legal education.
Well, again, it's a question of which unions we're talking about. All the unions affected. A lot of unions are talking about Teamsters, where you deliver goods to the marketplace. You know, they're still delivering goods to the marketplace. So, and a lot of these people are working. So we're talking about others who have basically been put out of work. People who work as waiters in restaurants, you know, ushers in movie theaters are not necessarily unionized. So there really is no union to take up their cause. And again, it's a question of coming into contact with the public. Now, the case could be made. Okay, so we don't have government action to close down. And people simply say we're afraid to come out because of the virus. Okay. So then there's no justification for invoking the Fifth Amendment. But then there is an argument for saying, okay, but let's compensate people in some fashion for their loss, because they're having a difficult time getting reemployment at the moment. That's the argument for your relief pack. But short of that, it's time to recognize this is not your standard recession. This is a government-sponsored recession, and this is government-sanctioned job loss. And this is a function of governmental actions that were taken. And nobody's willing to come forward and say that. at least not in democratic states.
Right. The democratic states, are we afraid? Are we afraid to challenge, you know, the powers that be? That too much of a heavy haul?
I think part
like
of the problem.
Where's the American Civil Liberties Union? I don't know where they are.
I think part
Maybe
of the problem
on vacation.
Is, yeah, I think part of the problem is that for so many years, particularly in the Trump years, there was this bias against, quote, science, climate science, and other kinds of science. And so basically it became a suspicion. So now the Democrats could basically say, see, we follow the science. Well, you follow some of the science, you don't follow all the science. And I have a problem when you say, I follow the science, as though that's some kind of orthodoxy. Orthodoxies are dangerous because, you know, there's no such thing as the science. There are things called scientific experiments which yield conflicting results. And it's all a matter of interpretation of those results. So you can basically say, yes, we all follow the science based on scientific method for doing these experiments, but there's no such thing as, quote, the science, unquote. Then you're basically elevating to an orthodoxy. Either you believe it, or you don't believe it. And if you don't believe it, now you're suspect. This is a problem. Public officials are there to weigh one set of issues or one piece of advice against other pieces of advice, one science against other science. As you know, some people have pointed out, you know, economics is, well, it may be a dismal science, but it's a science of some sort. But so that should be weighed against the science of public, public health. But not all public health people agree on the so-called science. You know, the science, quote, of the infectious disease person and the epidemiologist may not be the science of the primary care physician. We have to sort of recognize there are distinctions to be made here. The science that economists are bringing forth, they're dealing with the impact on the economy. That needs to be weighed in sort of in your cost-benefit analysis or your risk assessment. Even the most recent flap over, you know, Fauci, now he's flip-flopping, and therefore some people have called for him to be fired because, you know, he didn't answer the question, if you've gotten your second dose of the vaccine, can you see your grandkids?
Yeah.
He didn't really say you couldn't see your grandkids. He didn't want to be responsible for making a recommendation in the absence of evidence. But the real question is, why would anybody, if they're doing their own cost-benefit analysis, if they're a rational actor and they can think for themselves through the risk, why would you even ask? You'd say, yeah, look, I've got my second dose. I understand my kids have gotten their second doses. Yeah, I think it's probably okay to go see my grandkids, and that's what we're going to do. That's what most people would do. So here you say, let's defer to some public health expert. Who's not really going to comment, and shouldn't be commenting, in the absence of data.
Absolutely. And besides, you know, you can wear a mask, including the kids and including the elders and everybody in between. So very interesting that should be brought forward. Where do we go from here, or are we just now stuck in a little, you know, no man's land at the moment? What are we waiting for to engage all these issues? Or are we not waiting for anything? It'll just languish and we'll forget about it. And hopefully in another year or so, we'll be clearing the hurdle because so many people will have been inoculated. And hopefully we'll resume to some greater normalcy than we have at the moment.
Again, that may be an argument too for why public officials don't feel they need to compensate people for their losses. I think we have an opportunity that's missed here. I think part of it's also politics. You know, at least when you're doing things the way we're doing with the COVID relief bill, public officials have the opportunity to throw in anything which is not related. Because it serves their own particular constituents.
Wow. Unbelievable. So it looks like we're really stuck between a rock and a hard place, and we're not going in very quickly. So are there places where this is being discussed, or is it just you? You know, you're ahead of the curve. Sometimes it's not so good to be so far ahead of the curve because people have to catch up.
Well, it'd be nice if they were paying attention, but...
Well, I think they are paying attention. Very, very difficult. You do need consensus, even when it talks about politics and policies. People don't feel comfortable being outliers and coming up with concepts like this that make all the sense in the world. And a lot of people's lives are being affected by it. And there's no way around it. And there should be compensation for job loss, because there is also very little job creation while we're going through this process. Why is there reluctance of the state? Is it because it's going to cost too much money for the state to rectify these issues where they may have blundered?
It would still certainly cost the state more money if they had to compensate people for their losses in this particular way. So that's unconscionable as far as they're concerned. But again, if they were forced to do that, they would think twice about making the decisions that they made. They would only do it under the most drastic circumstances.
Yeah.
And it's possible they could have come to the same conclusions. They did. But, you know, at least have the public discussion. What you have here are decisions that are being made without any serious justification, without any serious explanation. Rather, it's basically all the arrogance of some governors is, I made a decision based on the science. That's very nice. What science did you make the decision on? Well, I made it on the science. What do you mean? How could you challenge it? It's the scientists. We listen to the scientists. So what?
Yeah.
But that's basically where we are. And I think people who can think rationally will certainly question those decisions and say, but look, it's fine to make a decision based on the science. Show us the science, show us the data, so we can actually look it over and come to the conclusion that it was a reasonable decision. That's all. But that's what you see going on right now.
Well, that's what you wouldn't expect, but we don't get that. You know, it's like they tell you the sky is green when it's really not. But they expect us to believe it, and quite often we do. I don't know how they get away with that. That's what happens. So it doesn't seem like we're going to get out of this very, very easily. Too many people will be unemployed with no jobs. This is going to be monumentally chaotic. You know, maybe we will have people waiting in line for food at this rate. Because you can't live on $7 an hour, and even on $15 an hour, I don't know if that's sufficient. Certainly not in New York. And in a lot of other places. New York may be expensive, but not everyone is living, you know, that way. So, you know, there are people in the Bronx at $15 an hour may be a lot for them. So I don't know. We're just stuck. Just stuck and no political effort to change the dynamic. I mean, can people actually sue the New York State or other states if there was a case against them based on this eminent domain issue?
I would think that you could do that. You should be able to do that. Again, I'm surprised that we have not seen any legal actions against states on this particular argument. We've seen actions of cases, pursuits brought before courts against states, particularly Michigan and Pennsylvania, on the grounds that these shutdowns are unconstitutional because they violate individual liberties and their right, people's right to earn a living, and basically it's violating their right to work. But nobody's really challenged on limited domain grounds, and I think there's, I would think that the argument is stronger. The emergency powers that the governors are being granted by their legislatures do not give them the right to violate all their liberties. It just basically gives them the right to make a decision in amidst a crisis, because after all, the legislative process is too slow and cumbersome. So a decision would have to be made on the grounds that you're supposedly saving lives, but it doesn't mean you can just willy-nilly just take people's property away.
What's interesting just came to mind is, you know, in New York State, we've got a Democrat who's the governor. But there are other states that have a Republican as a governor. Is there any difference in their attitude towards this issue? Or is it exactly the same? They're not using eminent domain.
I think it's a question of degree, and again, I think you'd say the same thing. Obviously, in some red states, have seen less inclination to shut down to the degree that you've seen in blue states. But again, I don't know whether that's because they are Republicans per se versus Democrats, or if it's simply that the characteristics of their states are vastly different than the characteristics of some of these large, more populous blue states. So if you're taking, again, talking about South Dakota versus New York or South Dakota versus California, we're not talking about, apples and apples comparisons. We're talking about apples and orange comparisons. So that's your problem there. It's very nice to have this monolithic view of, well, we've got our red states and we've got our blue states. Obviously, the red states are working well, very well. Clearly, there have been differences in how Florida has approached this versus New York and California. But again, I think there must be some clear differences in population size, composition, and other things in Florida versus New York or Florida versus California, which extend beyond blue state governors and red state governors. There are clearly politics there, but I think there are also issues of how you approach this. And again, you can say, look, we want social distancing, we want mitigation in place. Mm-hmm. We are going to force you to reduce your capacity. But again, a state like Florida, where it's warm, you can have much of your restaurant activity taking place outdoors. So you don't really have to shut down to the same degree that you do in New York, where it's 30 degrees out. You're not going to sit outside in the cold right now, particularly when it's snowing. Right. New York, New Jersey, on the upper seaboard. So this is your basic problem. What you have in California, I think, is a more problem. More of a problem, because you basically have arbitrary decisions being made. Well, certain restaurants can have outdoor dining, other restaurants cannot. And without any real explanation for why we're making those distinctions.
Yeah, you even brought up in your article about you may have restaurants have one rule, and then there's movie theaters have another rule, and gyms have another rule. It doesn't make sense. It does spell arbitrariness. So it there's no logic to it. I don't know. Well, this doesn't sound like we're going to resolve this very soon. amazing. How does one move this whole issue forward, or can one, other than the discussion that we're having? Do you expect politically there'd be an initiative by one state or another to move this forward? Or are they also scared of coming out of the norm?
I don't see it happening at the moment. Again, politics is involved. If you're calling on the ACLU to take the lead, the ACLU doesn't want us to be seen as an organization which in any way is backing what would be a policy directive of a red state governor. So that's your set of politics right there. I think the larger issue is that nobody's really thought about this issue, and nobody, and it's a question of getting attention for this particular way of thinking.
What about a blue state? Would they be interested in doing it for that?
The blue state.
To control the whole issue.
The blue states, again, will probably not want to take up the issue via this approach because they don't want to be seen as a shilling for businesses as opposed to shilling for labor.
Wow. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Politically.
Good thing. Good thing.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Professor, any last words from you? This has been stimulating. I think people will be thinking about it all weekend long. Hopefully something will come out of it.
Not the moment.
Okay, well, I'll let you go, and then we'll be able to talk about some of the writings that you've been able to pen and give people a better understanding of who you are if they don't know you yet. Thank you very, very much. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, here we have it, folks, Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He is a socioeconomic research scholar, and we were talking to him about the Fifth Amendment and to the Constitution and how it relates to people who are trying to make a living and whose capacity has been diminished because the science that some state governors want to abide by, and it doesn't always work. Well, you should know that the professor is the author of Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, which are arguments for middle class. And this is published by Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E. And then another work that he did, Understanding Public Policy in the United States. And this one is issued by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. And then I got introduced to him through the work called The Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook. And this one is published by ABC, the American Broadcasting Corporation. So, but ABC-CLIO, and that's who they are. They're an American Broadcasting Corporation affiliate and or division. And then there's the work that he did called The Case of the Minimum Wage, Competing Policy Models. And this one was published by the State University of New York Press. Exceptional work. And in case you didn't know, Oren M. Levin-Waldman is a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University based in Newark. And as well, he is socioeconomic research scholar at Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. Well, you could learn more about him through his own website. It's called Labor Econ, so www.econlabor.com. econlabor.com. So it's econlabor.com, and you can direct mail him if you wanted to. Real easy. It's Olevin Waldman, Waldman. So Olevin Waldman at gmail.com. And you can go to Econ Labor at www.econlabor.com. And you could reach him at his office at 914-629-6351. So there we have it. Amazing, amazing, amazing to look into. Well, I didn't realize because I made a mistake at my end. I'm getting my second inoculation tomorrow, and it's a long ride getting there and a long ride coming back. So I need to cancel some of the scheduled for tomorrow, I think all of the entire day. So we won't be able to attend that. And we'll be back on Friday. And I'll leave notice on the website with regard to what we're going to do. And that's my second inoculation. I'd completely forgotten about it, but they sent me an email to remind me. So I have to be prepared for tomorrow. And that's about it. So we're also going to close down early today because I need to catch up with a lot of other issues that have already been written to some extent and needs to be posted. So that's the story. So we're going to shut down early today. Have a great day. Thanks for being with us. And of course, thank you to Professor Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, the socioeconomic researcher, brilliant mind. And hopefully people heard and will consider taking them up on some of these issues because they're very, very pertinent. All right, so there we are. All the best, folks. We'll speak to you on Friday. Goodbye.